Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey everyone, it's been a couple of months since I started Come For Supper, and we've had some new listeners, so thank you for tuning in. I thought it would be nice to go back and listen to some of my favourite episodes. So this week we have a special episode and we'll be listening to Mira Manic. Hey everyone, and welcome to Come For Supper. I'm Alexandra Dudley, food writer, cook, and serial dinner party host. So I thought it'd be fun to sit down with people who share that love for food, chat about life, and learn a little bit more about how they like to serve supper. I speak to chefs, restaurateurs, artists, actors, authors, and pretty much anyone who likes to entertain. If you're new to the podcast, make sure you click subscribe. And if you enjoy it, rate it, review it, share it, and tell your friends, as it makes all the difference. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. Today in the studio, we have a woman whose love for healthy food and Indian ingredients have captured the hearts of many. Her first cookbook, Saffron Soul, was published in 2017, and her second book, Prajna, the Ayurvedic Rituals for Happiness, has just come out. She is also the owner of the incredibly popular Soho Cafe, Chai by Mira, which I can personally vouch for serving one of the best chais in London. And her famous chai spice mix is used by many restaurants too. When she's not writing or at the cafe, she hosts supper clubs, workshops, and retreats. She is a very busy woman. Welcome to the studio, Mira.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks for having me, and what a wonderful introduction.
Oh, you're welcome. I mean, I could have gone on. I feel like I have to pare it back sometimes.
Oh, that's so,
that
so
I don't. You know, otherwise it's too much of me speaking. So where have you come from this afternoon?
I love listening, so that's fine. I've come from my cafe. It's been a bit of a busy day, but I actually was at Young British Food Awards this morning judging on a panel, and the awards are going to be given out at the end of this month, and that was very exciting. So it's been a bit of a oddly busy day, from there to the cafe to here and then to a book launch that we're both going to.
Yeah, it's very cool. I suppose you can't give away any secrets, but what does it entail, the judging? Are you tasting things? Are you just judging on what they've done?
So interestingly, this particular category of YBFs was, it's all about sort of their story and what okay. their story is, what they're trying to include in their food, and what stories they're telling through food. And so it was a very different sort of category. So yes, two of them brought food. One of them wasn't able to. She actually writes a blog called Curry and Cancer. Really interesting lady, Saima. And she wasn't able to because she had an hospital appointment this morning.
Wow, okay.
So it's really interesting to have these brilliantly inspiring people, and the other two are about to launch their restaurants very soon. And are bringing to life cultures through food, which is really
nice.
What food is all about now, I think. Yeah. People are so interested in the stories.
Yeah, and the language, I think. I say it a lot, but food is essentially, it's just another form of communication, and it's sort of a universal language, which I think is something that's so beautiful about it.
And that's why I found this particular thing, this particular category, and this morning so exciting and interesting, because that's exactly through my first book, which was a cookbook, I basically told stories of, I guess, the women behind food, my family, my mum, my grandmother, my aunts, who I've grown up eating their food, and they've been cooking all their lives. And just sort of that story in itself has now translated into so much more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what my book was about. Yes, of course it was about the food. And it is, the focus is the food. But through that, I just want to do a lot more.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about your childhood then. So you grew up in London, but you come from a family that has strong kind of Indian heritage. Am I right that you learned Sanskrit at school?
Yeah,
I did. That's quite cool.
Yes, it's the only school in London.
I was going to say, I'm trying to think of schools where
and
you can do that.
And it's a English, Christian, normal school.
It's very cool.
Yeah, so
that.
we were in Queen's Gate in South Kensington for like most of my life. That was where my school was, and now it's moved to Hammersmith, and it's called St. James, and they still teach Sanskrit. When I was there, it was compulsory. I believe it's not compulsory anymore, but from the age of four, we studied Sanskrit with English teachers. It wasn't even like Indian teachers. So it was quite amazing that they actually learned Sanskrit. To think now that if I learned Sanskrit late in life, how difficult it would be to pick it up.
Yeah.
Whereas when you learn from the age of four, it's very different. You're picking up a language easily at that age. So I did GCSE and A-level Sanskrit.
Very cool.
Which actually was really interesting from the perspective of traveling in India and going to all these like recitals that my spiritual teacher did, because he would focus on the scriptures that I studied in school. So it was like I was sort of living the things that I was studying, which was fascinating in a way, and kind of
unique,
making connections. And obviously that sort of stays with you for your whole life.
And what about food? Was it something that you were interested in from kind of that young age as well?
No, actually. I think food was just a part and parcel of life. I never thought of food as something other than, you know, what I came home and ate. I was very structured with my eating, you know, my family. It was very healthy. We also went to a school which was, in that day and age, organic wasn't really heard of. And it was organic and it was vegetarian. That's primarily why my parents chose it, because they were so intent on the vegetarian side.
So were you brought up as a vegetarian?
Yes.
Really? Okay. Because your first book... And you're a vegetarian today, still? Because your first book was entirely vegetarian. And it came out in 2017, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And I know from experience that you write the book about a year before you see it on the shelf. So that means you were writing it in 2016. And I think now vegetarianism, veganism, you know, it's pretty mainstream. Like restaurants have vegetarian menus, restaurants are vegan and vegetarian. But back then, did you feel like it was a risk?
I know veganism was getting very, very popular at that time, but not as popular as it is now.
Yeah.
Veganism is obviously more trendy than being vegetarian. It's almost like people understand veganism before vegetarianism. But at the time, vegetarianism was there like a lot. I mean, it was only 2 years ago. I would say 10 years ago was a bit different, not 2 years ago. But my publishers were very keen on not making it primarily a vegan cookbook that happens to be healthy. It was more like, this is an Indian cookbook that happens to be healthy.
That's what I mean.
And vegetarian.
You wouldn't know from the title or from the front cover. Like most vegetarian books, I think, that had come out prior to that whole wave, they were the vegetarian cookbook or cook vegetarian or vegetarian weekday cooking or something. Yes. And this was just a book that happened to be a vegetarian.
Yeah, that's exactly how we sort of, you know, we sat down and had the meeting. We were debating how, in fact, the first title we worked with was Healthy Indian.
Okay.
Because that was my hashtag all along. And I'm so glad that we didn't do that, because this has turned out to be a timeless book now.
Yeah,
because of the fact that it's a beautiful coffee table book and it just happens to be healthy and vegetarian and primarily vegan. It just happens to be timeless, because anyone who eats meat who picks it up can cook from it, because they don't need to be like, oh, this is vegetarian, we're not going to touch
that. Yeah, they won't even notice.
It's almost like the flavours, it doesn't really matter whether it's vegetarian or not, which is really nice. I mean, at the time, maybe vegan would have done better, or maybe now vegan would do better. But I just think I'm not saying that's a trend. I think it's here to stay, but I do think it's nice to have a timeless book.
Yeah,
it's a
great
book. Thank you.
And then your second book, Women of Many Talents, is not a cookbook. So can you tell us a little bit more about it and sort of why you decided to write it?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. The whole journey was very. It's funny because it wasn't what I had in mind. I always thought my second book would be a cookbook. In fact, I never even thought I would write a cookbook. I wrote novels before and I haven't published those novels. So I actually was going to be a writer of novels to start with.
Wow.
So the cookbook that happened again took me by surprise as well. But then I thought my second book would be another cookbook. And I started thinking about what that would be. And I was thinking feasts, because I do supper clubs and that sort of thing. But actually this book, and since the idea came about, this book has sort of brought together all the passions, interests that I have, the things that I've grown up doing and living and breathing in a way, and my own journey back to well-being, back to healthfulness, back to sort of life, because I went through, you know, I think when you go through a tragic experience in life or any sort of trauma, there are tools that you pick up and you use, and you don't realize what those tools are until that time strikes. And you over time realize what your toolbox will look like. And those tools that I picked up, whether it was yoga, which, well, initially it was yoga, you know, healthy, but going back to healthy food. I had a very bad relationship with food before that. The sun really helped me. I was living in Dubai at the time, and I was going through a really long divorce, and I was in between Dubai and London. I was going to India a lot, and the sun really, really helped me. And I think whenever I came to London, I'd get dragged down again. And
I know that feeling.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, we all sort of, London does have that, but I love it. I love London. It's a great city. But, you know, that sort of dreary grey sky thing affects you a lot more when you're going through a troublesome experience. And then, you know, over time, you know, realizing what I really loved and going and doing Kundalini yoga, realizing the capacity and the power of the breath, and obviously the things that I grew up doing, whether it was chanting, whether it was sort of meditation. You know, in my school we were taught meditation, and I'm not a real big meditator. I don't just sit there and just meditate for like 10-20 minutes every single day, but I do believe in the power of just sitting still, or like understanding what's going on in your head and actually observing it. And that in itself is meditation. I talk in this book about moments of stillness and actually meditation being in the moment of what you're doing, which is basically mindfulness. Mm. If I'm sitting here and really being enjoying mindful, or if I love art and I love painting and I'm going to sit there and paint for 10 minutes in the day, that is my meditation. So I speak about that in the book as well. But of course, there's the other side of meditation, which is going into that sort of form of dhyana, of like stillness, of closing your eyes and actually going into that thought process. But it's just so interesting how these things have become amazingly relevant today. Things that I sort of grew up doing, and these sets of this toolbox has essentially become a toolbox of rituals. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that I use these rituals every day, but that's what this book is about, picking and choosing what comes to you, and understanding these little things that come from India in a way that's accessible. That's a very long answer for a short question.
It's great. I got it, but like very luckily sneaky peek of it this morning. And it's also, it's a small book. You can hold it in your hand. Yeah. It's very different to when you hold a cookbook. It's this, which is this kind of big bulky thing. And this, I think what's so nice about it as well is that you could just carry this around with you and dip in and out of it. And often actually when I read books that are sort of about, I don't know, mindfulness or, you know, my like self-help shelf, they are the kind of books that you can dip in and out of. And I think they're so refreshing, those sorts of books, because you just sort of, you'll sort of open it and you don't know what you'll find, but inevitably you're going to find something that you'll need and that will be useful. And what's lovely about this is you have got a few recipes in here as well, which I think when you know, for you, obviously cooking is such a big part of what you do.
And I tried to do recipes. I tried to bring up, include recipes that are really sort of everyday for me.
Yeah, easy, simple.
Yeah, things that you can, simple, but using spices in a very everyday way. So understanding how spices can flavour your food in a very easy way, but also in a way that also makes it more flavourful. So it makes it more interesting. Mm-hmm. So how do you use those spices in a very calming, ritualistic, I guess, way? And just pepper all your food with different ingredients, different spices. So it just becomes a little bit more interesting, mm-hmm. rather than boring, I guess. And so I've tried to really focus on recipes that I would just do every single day. We were initially thinking of putting pictures in the book, and I
like it like this, actually.
But we decided, I think it's really lovely. Good as a gift book. And like, you know,
exactly. It's such a good gift book.
Yeah.
So it's got like a fabulous bright pink cover as well, which I really approve of.
Oh,
it looks
you.
Fab. So in Sanskrit, the word Ayurveda translates to the science of life. And I know that in India, it's known as the mother of healing. Mm. So I'm sure you have a lot of wisdom in it. But for people who don't know, can you talk to us a little bit about the principles of Ayurveda?
Yeah, absolutely. So Ayurveda is the sort of system of medicine in India, which came about many, many years ago. And it's sort of ingrained in the lives of people in India, so much so that it's a part of life. So, you know, growing up here, even though, so my family actually came from India to Africa, to Uganda, and my great-grandparents, and then my family was born in Africa. And so when they came to London through the Idi Amin exodus, what the sort of version of India that we have and we've grown up with is very, very old. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of very traditional in so many ways, which India is, but it has also moved on from that. So when you talk about, I mean, I can speak about the food, or I can speak about culture, or the dress sense, or fashion, or whatever it is. But when you talk about sort of well-being and rituals and Ayurveda, I didn't grow up knowing necessarily the word Ayurveda, but things that we did, I didn't realize were essentially Ayurvedic. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whether it's the tongue scraper, which has become so popular these days, I had no idea.
And why do people do that? Why do you do that?
I did that since I don't even remember when I wasn't doing that. You know, I did that from the minute I could brush my teeth. And the only reason I continued to do it is because I thought, oh, it's weird not to do it. I think once you start doing it, it's very weird not to do it, because then you feel like there's a film of something on your tongue, and it just feels odd. But obviously now I realize the reason. So the reason is that you get a film of like ama, which is toxins, on your tongue every morning while you sleep. And so ideally you want a copper a tongue scraper, and that will remove the ama toxins from the tongue in the morning. And so it's actually very, very good for you. As is sort of coconut oil pulling, which a lot of people do. That's not something that I grew up doing.
Okay.
I have put it in the book because it's very Ayurvedic. But a lot of people do it, and they find it's great for the teeth. It's good for, like, again, getting rid of ama. And the principles of Ayurveda is basically what I think are the principles of living, really, which is to try and fast between your meals. I'm just going to go through a few of the main key principles. So fasting between meals, so not over snacking, for example, because that will ignite the Agni, which is the digestive fire, which needs to be ignited in order to receive and digest the next meal. So try and make sure that there's like a gap of 4 hours between this meal and the next meal. Also, waking up and trying to make sure that your digestive system is in tune with the sun. So trying to have breakfast, lunch and dinner according to when the sun is at its strongest. Mm-hmm. So actually having your biggest meal at lunchtime is the best way to do it. But that said, I think also what I talk about in this book and what my research has shown is that if you're living in this day and age and you have a really stressful job and you can't really take the time out to have a relaxed lunch, then it's better not to do that. Mm-hmm. It's better to try and just have a bigger meal at dinner, but just try not to have it too late.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to be stressed and eating that big meal at lunch, you're going to scoff it down and you're not going to be able to chew it. And one of the main principles, as we all know, with digestion is chew your food properly. Yeah. And also if you're super stressed, you're not going to be able to digest that food. So it's working with Ayurveda. Sorry, it's Ayurveda working with your life. Ayurveda working with your lifestyle, and making sure that you don't try and apply these ancient principles in your day-to-day life if it doesn't work for you practically. Mm-hmm. I obviously just touched upon Agni, which is the digestive fire, and that's really, really important, because just understanding how that works and making sure that you sort of go in tune with nature as well, because as Ayurveda says that you come from nature, you're not born into nature. And so you want to be in tune with nature. So things are like, in the book, I also speak about like walking in nature, tree worship,
so
and that sort of,
all of that. Being outside is just key, I think, for your like mental happiness.
Exactly. And there is obviously lots of research to show why that's true. And in Japan, they actually have something called forest bathing, which is so interesting.
Lie in the forest naked?
No. It's just the walking.
Shame. I would definitely do that. I was like, I feel like I do that anyway.
Let's go do that. That would be really interesting. But yeah, because there's a lot of forests in Japan and it's called forest bathing, you actually go into the forest and
you immerse yourself.
You know, you feel your feet on the ground. Yeah. You listen to the rustle of the leaves. You sort of feel the wind on your skin and that sort of thing. And it's trying to meditate essentially in the forest. And it's actually got a name. It's called Shinrin Yoku. It's beautiful. So that, again, I touch upon that in the book. We don't have such a thing, but we do have a real sort of importance of trees in India.
Yeah.
And tree worship is a thing. And so understanding the sort of our relationship with nature is really important. And other things are, obviously, you may have heard of doshas, which have become...
So I was wondering if you were going to say that, because I love talking about doshas.
Yeah.
It's my new favourite thing to talk about. Yeah. going to make a podcast on doshas.
We should. I don't know.
You should. You definitely should.
No, doshas are really, I mean, they are important because obviously understanding your constitution will allow you to understand what works for you yeah. and what kind of personality you are, what kind of yoga or exercise you need, or whether you need more rest or more, or do you have more energy in your life to do more things? So, and what foods you should eat, obviously. But I don't focus a lot on doshas in my book. I'm talking okay. more about, in my book, I talk more about the Ayurvedic lifestyle as opposed to the practical sort of nitty gritties of what mm-hmm. Ayurveda constitution is all about.
Okay. But you have recipes in there, and there is that kind of strong link, I think, between food and food being medicine. As yes. well as principles and Ayurvedic kind of habits and rituals being medicine, but food being a way to sort of self-heal, self-medicate. But it's almost like prevent, not cure.
Absolutely.
That's sort of from what totally. From my dosha and Ayurvedic reading, that's yeah, sort of what I've gathered.
Agree, so yeah.
I wanted to ask you, have you kind of, because you've talked about how you went through, you know, difficult times in your life, or, you know, you changed your relationship with food. But have you experienced firsthand how sort of eating in that kind of Ayurvedic way, chewing your food, eating slower? I know that eating or not eating really cold food is something that's quite important. Have you yes, experienced firsthand that that's
totally.
Kind of...
I have
affected
such,
you.
Yeah, yeah. It's affected me specifically because, and that's partly why I actually went to a lot of Ayurvedic resorts when I was younger. In my teenage years and in my 20s, I went to a lot of spas and Ayurvedic resorts in India.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, it was really amazing. But partly because I actually had very bad digestion.
Okay.
And I didn't realize, but I made that a lot worse by the sort of pattern of eating that I
yeah.
had. So when I left my first school, I went to a much bigger school for A-levels. And I think that really affected me because my like routine with food completely went out of sync. Mm-hmm. And from then onwards, I started, you know, putting on weight or having acne or whatever yeah. it was. And those sorts of things were also then exacerbated by things in the media, you know, media telling us that we should have low-fat diets yeah. and that sort of thing. So my awareness of food became greater, but in a very bad way, mm-hmm. because I realized that, oh my God, I shouldn't be having any oil. And then I'd stop eating curries and like dal, which yeah. is ridiculous. I really replaced things like proper Indian meals with like Special K bars and
yeah,
and
sad,
those sorts of things.
Sad Special K bars. God, I remember
ridiculous,
the
right? And then
diet.
I'd wonder why my energy is
yeah,
low.
Terrible.
Like, I had no
yeah.
idea. It took me years to sort of understand what I was doing wrong, or that I was even doing something mm-hmm. wrong. I would just snack all day, and that's how yeah. I developed this really awful relationship with food. Which, essentially, I grew up eating Ayurvedic cuisine or food, and what I realized is that my food habits were sort of out of sync and out of routine, but also because I had a lot of cold foods, and I'd yeah. travel, and then I'd have, so cold foods didn't work, especially for me. I mean, I think it also depends on your climate. Mm-hmm. I mean, also your constitution, if your specific dosha type or whatever it is, cooked foods are better for you. But generally, as a rule, Ayurveda says that have cooked foods, don't have raw foods,
loads
especially
of raw
at
food.
Night.
Yeah.
But I do think it's to do with where you live as well. If you're in LA and, or in, I don't know, hotter climate, you will be far more inclined to have salads for lunch or even sometimes for dinner than you would in a country like London when it's in winter time.
I think it's like you eat more fruit as well, isn't it,
yeah.
when you're away, because you need that kind of liquid and that sugar
yes.
and you don't need to eat kind of, you know, when I'm away I'll eat a peach and then I'll eat watermelon and then I'll eat more
exactly.
fruit, and I don't go around eating loads of fruit in London. I mean, at the moment I'm eating a lot of peaches because we got some good peaches, but
yeah.
do you know what, I think it is your environment as well.
It is and you
that.
Have to work with your season, you have to work with where you are located. And seasonal, all of that is, I mean, we all speak about seasonal eating,
mm-hmm.
but that is Ayurvedic as well.
Yeah, it's also how we're meant to eat.
I mean, Ayurveda doesn't have to be India. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, no,
you
can, I totally
Italians could
you.
Be eating very Ayurvedically.
I mean, the Mediterranean diet is
exactly.
almost quite Ayurvedic if you think about it.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's chat a little bit about entertaining, and because we are on Come for Supper. What do we get when we come to Mira Manik's house for supper? How do you like to entertain?
I love sharing plates. That's exactly what I do for my supper clubs, like the way you do it. I love all your food. Delicious, honestly. I'm still dreaming of that fig.
Black olive fig and rosemary.
That was so good. I'm going to come over for that again. So at my supper clubs, I basically do large sharing plates and platters of, say, for example, my masala grilled aubergine or like a kale, date and red cabbage salad with almond flakes and a coriander cashew dressing. So everything's quite
delicious.
Everything has a lot of spices, but not spice, if you know what I mean.
Because I'm not heat, not chili, not fieriness.
Okay. Yeah. And I actually, I'm not into, like, I don't particularly like having a lot of chili in my food anyway. So chili would also be there a little bit. Like, I'll put, I don't know, in the coriander dressing, I might blend in one chili, but that'll go a long way. You don't really taste that too much. So it's very lightly spiced, and yet there's spice in everything. So there'll be the masala mix that's layered on the aubergine has got like eight spices, plus a blend of like tahini and ground cashews and water. So it's like spread on top like a miso grilled aubergine almost.
Delicious.
And jaggery, which is an earthy natural sweetener, because our food from Gujarat, what sets it apart is that sort of balance between lime and sweetness in your actual main dishes, which is really lovely, which you don't get in the rest of India. So I try and include those flavors a lot, because that's a part of India that I'm from, and that's a food that I've grown up eating. So I take mixes and spice mixes that, you know, I've grown up eating, and applying them to sort of more modern dishes or changing them a little bit. And then I'll have a dal, maybe a soup to start
Delicious.
With. Like if it's winter time, I'll have like a mung bean soup to start with. But mung bean sounds so boring, and it is kind of boring, but I just spice it up with lots of ginger.
Yeah.
So it tastes quite like. And coconut milk. I like using coconut milk because there's a lot of vegans who come to my events. And so I'd rather than not, because I love using yogurt, I swap that for coconut milk sometimes.
It's got that nice kind of depth of kind of creaminess.
And I do
it.
Love yogurt though. I think Indian food, that's why it's tricky
it's
to
cooling,
eat.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's cooling. And it's got that natural tanginess, which natural yogurt does, not necessarily Greek thick yogurt. But it's such a nice sort of, it also cools down the palate if you're having chilies in your food. And then I'll have one or two snacks, like, you know, from my book, maybe it's dhokla, which is the soft sort of spongy yellow square.
That's delicious.
Things.
I was going to ask what that was. I felt bad that I've forgotten the name. That's
one
delicious.
Of my favorite things. Yeah. So delicious. Literally is my favorite snack. Or I'll have baked savory cake, which is called andvor. And then I'll have the second course might have one curry, but again, it won't be a curry like a soupy curry. It'll be a lot more like a beetroot and coconut curry, which
like
is
a dry curry.
And then maybe a bread of some sort. Sometimes I'll do cauliflower rice with like lots of vegetables, but lots of flavor. And I always put like this charred corn in it so that there's some crunch.
Oh, delicious. Oh my goodness.
And that's so, yeah, I change it up a lot. Sometimes I'll have like beetroot and sweet potato patties, or the mung bean patties from my book. I try and like use things in my book, but then add different elements to it and different layers. And then dessert will always be, not always, but sometimes, most of the time, I'll do the saffron lime cheesecake because people love that. It's vegan and everyone just absolutely loves that. Or I'll do some type of fudge, which is with the chicken.
Your fudge
flour
is quite famous. Mira's fudge, although you also say it's kind of like a non-fudge.
It's not.
You?
Yeah, it's not fudge. It's
but
basically
it's, you know, that,
made,
that
it
fudge
tastes fudgy, and a lot of people think it's got peanut butter in it, and it tastes like peanut butter. But it's actually literally chickpea flour, dates, coconut oil, and then either I spice it with cardamom, which is normally what I do. But then if it's a dessert at an event, I'll try and mix it up with like cacao and cinnamon and like an all spice mix, and then I'll put like cashew cream with vanilla
it.
Or something, and like berries, so it's like a hot thing.
Wow, yum.
Yeah,
so the fudge will be hot, or the cashew cream.
No, the fudge will be hot. So I sometimes just like, because when you cook the fudge, you actually make it in a pan and it is hot, it's piping hot, but then I layer it and I, you know, chop it up in pieces. But rather than do that, you just
serve it
hot as a sort of, it's actually in my book, it's called the traditional name, which is montal, and that is served a lot of the times hot. It's just that I've made it into these pieces, so Yeah.
Delicious. I can see, I can sense Jack salivating. Jack's very kindly recording us.
Well, Jack, we've got some vegan cheesecake with us and it's got the fudge as the base, so you can definitely have that after.
And what about do's and don'ts when entertaining? Do you have anything that you sort of rules for people? Because you do a lot of entertaining, I do a lot of entertaining, but a lot of people shy away from entertaining because they're, you know, they're afraid they're going to mess up. Do you have any kind of tips?
Yeah, so I think with entertaining, just make sure you're prepared, because there are times when I'm not, where I haven't been as prepared as other times, and then I can't enjoy myself. Like, mm-hmm. I'm running around doing things. I'm like, actually, if I'd prepared a little bit better, or if I had a bit more help, then I'd be able to enjoy this moment a bit more. But also being on your toes and being able to sort of making sure everyone has everything they need and making sure there's more food than less.
Yeah.
Always having a bit extra.
That's a very...
Sometimes when things run out, it's a little bit like, that's the thing that sticks with me.
Yeah, you remember
afterwards.
It.
And yeah.
You probably remember it more than the guests, but I agree with you there.
Exactly. And it's just not nice to, you know, someone, if there is a little bit left over, you can always like pack it up for somebody.
That's really nice. That's a lovely tip.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. I don't always remember to take boxes or like containers with me, and I'm always regret it, because if there's a supper club and there's lots of food left over, I want to pack it for people, but how do I pack it for them? So I always
jam jars. I always say keep jam jars. Get everyone to bring a jam jar.
Yeah, you should actually, you know, we should include that at the bottom of like
invites. Please bring jam jars. Perfect. So you do supper clubs, you do pop-ups, you do retreats, and then you also run your cafe. Was it always a plan to run something? Was that, once you kind of fell into food, did you dream, have that kind of in
never, your- literally. I don't think even, no, this time last year I wouldn't know, because I would have been starting it. I started it last November. But if you'd asked me last July, I would have no idea that I was going to start a cafe. And I didn't even, not necessarily even dream of it. I never really thought that was my thing.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even know where to begin. It just came up. The opportunity came up because I used to go to Try Yoga a lot, mm-hmm. because my cafe is inside the yoga studio inside Try Yoga in Kingly Court. And the opportunity came up because Try Yoga offered it to me at the time, and I jumped on it and said yes, because it was a sort of setup where I was walking in, but you know, making it my own, and it was just the most wonderful location. I absolutely love being in Kingly Court, and it really just worked out. I mean, it was much harder work than I thought initially.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize how much goes into just running the business element or setting up a cafe. Maybe I wouldn't have said yes if I knew all the nitty-gritties that went into it. But I said yes, and, you know, I'm so glad I said yes. It's been a crazy whirlwind of a year, but I love being located inside, or, you know, working with a brand like Try Yoga, because that's where my yoga journey began, mm-hmm. in London. I've always loved Try Yoga. I love some of the teachers there. They know me. And it really works well with my new book. I don't know if that book.
And you run events there as well, which, like, you know, you speak to kind of interesting people, philosophers, and all different kinds of scientists. You speak to all different kinds of people.
Yes. I run Try Stories there. Yes, exactly. So I've had like Giles Eo, who is an incredible geneticist from Cambridge University, who has written a book called Gene Eating. And then we've had like the latest one was an astrologer, Francesco Oddi. So that was really interesting.
Very cool.
So we've had a real sort of range of people. You know, the girl who launched the first ever vegan cookery school in London, Lauren Lover, and then my very good friend Anjali Mata, who wrote the skincare bible. So it's a real sort of range in the well-being field, but also in the food field, a kind of crossover. And I love also just working alongside yoga teachers. So my next event, one of my launch events on my book, is actually a yoga brunch with Try Yoga with one of my favorite yoga teachers, Leila Sardeghi, on Sunday 15th September, and to launch the book in Try Yoga.
So nice.
So it's a really
full circle.
Yeah, it really does feel like a full circle.
Yeah, and it definitely, I know I said it earlier in the intro where I wasn't just brushing you up, but you do a very good chai.
Oh, thank you.
Is that recipe, I'm looking at it now, I'm reading it in the book, I'm like first dibs, I'm trying to work
so
out what's exactly
ways
in it.
Of using on baking a chai.
Is this the one that you grew up with? Is it similar to what you kind of drunk growing up?
Yes, in a way it is, because every family has their own specific spice blend that they put into their chai, into their tea to make it a chai. And every family sort of has their, you know, more ginger or more pepper or more cinnamon, mm-hmm. or whatever it is. And when we came up with this recipe, my grandmother and my mother helped me come up with the recipe. But what was really interesting and fascinating as well is that when we added the sugar element to it, so what we usually do and what India does is that they have a spice mix, which is just the spices, mm-hmm. and they add it into the boiling chai or the boiling tea leaves and everything, milk, water, and they boil it together and they add the sugar to that. But what I came up with when I started supplying to cafes like 4 years ago is a spice blend which actually has the coconut sugar mixed inside into it. And that changed the proportions. I couldn't keep the same proportions. It just tasted really odd. So I had to change the amount of ginger, the amount of... Mm-hmm. So we tried so many... Like, I remember the 2 days that we were trying it, I could not have any more sugar, anything. It was just like, I am so chied out. And same with my grandmother and my mother. But we all came up with the recipe together because it took so much time to actually figure out the proportions. And there is a lot more ginger and a lot more cardamom in our chai. But India generally...
Yeah, it's definitely that cardamom. I love cardamom. It's definitely got that kind of cardamom-y.
Yeah, and I think...
Cardamominess?
Cardamominess. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. It is a thing. Gingeriness. Ginger and cardamom are the most sort of... But the funny thing is that when people think of chai and when people think of chai latte, they think of cinnamon and sweetness. Mm-hmm. I used to think of that. I used to think cinnamon was like the most prominent spice in the chai mix. But actually, it's not in the slightest. Even when you go to India, when they're making chai on the streets, all the chai wallahs will have different types of chai. And one of them will be grating ginger, fresh mm-hmm. ginger into his chai without anything else. And another one will, in Punjab, for example, they use a lot more just crushed cardamom. So there'll be a lot more of that cardamom flavour and nothing else. And then in some places, they'll just have the spice mix, which is the powder that they put into the chai because that's just easier. Mm-hmm. And some places they'll put lemongrass, like fresh lemongrass leaves, and they'll like boil it with that. And some places they'll put mint leaves. So sometimes I'll boil my chai with mint leaves. So you can really just put whatever you want. And there's pepper in there. My one contains a bit of white pepper and a black pepper, mm-hmm. nutmeg, clove. Again, nutmeg and clove are not prominent at all. In fact, my chai spice could be made without them. So I put very little of nutmeg and clove. But ginger and cardamom are the most prominent spices, and that's what makes any chai really a chai.
Yeah.
It's not the cinnamon. But yeah, it is very specific to me. And I think partly because I mix the sugar into it, so it doesn't vary anywhere. And it's headier than what you get and spicier and more authentic than what you get.
Yeah, it's very kind
there.
Of rich. Like, it's got a real depth. Kind of, it's like an adventure of flavours in there.
I also think coconut sugar has that sort of sense of
carameliness as well.
Yeah, and it has that earthiness to it. Mm-hmm. Which
I didn't actually know you used coconut sugar in it. I haven't used coconut sugar in a long time, but it does have that sort of sweet... kind of rich caramelly tone,
doesn't it?
Treacle. It's got a treacle. Now, I often find it when you use it, you can use a bit less of it than you would with conventional sugar because it brings a flavour along with it.
Mm.
You're not just using it to pull out a flavour, it brings one
on. Yeah, it has a flavour. Exactly, it has a flavour, which is so nice. And it reminds me a little bit of jaggery. Jaggery's hard to use. I love jaggery, but it's hard to use.
Harder to find, too.
Because it comes in blocks and you need to melt it. So it's not easy to find it granular. Anyway, next question.
You talk a lot about the importance of the spice box and bringing it back to spices.
Yes,
and using it playfully. And I know that you're a big fan of not kind of just confining it to curries and dals and traditional Indian cooking. Where else do you kind of like to use spice, or where else do you like to see people using spice that you think it's maybe kind of not used enough?
Yeah, I think for me, I came from that sort of perspective of not having cooked a lot and then entering the kitchen in my 30s, for example. Mm-hmm. I did cook before that, but not much. I realized that I came from a point of fascination when I started cooking in my 30s. I came into the kitchen and understood these flavors that I'd grown up eating and was like, oh my God, these are the spices that make my food what it tastes like. It's delicious. And so I started experimenting with those spices and using, for example, cumin powder in a stir fry. And I know people do that, but people think of cumin as I think of cumin seeds as a very Indian ingredient. Mm-hmm. But those sorts of things, or roasting your sweet potatoes or potatoes in the oven with rosemary, but also adding cumin seeds.
Yeah.
Or, you know, making a tarka mix, which is the fried spice mix in oil with mustard seeds, cumin seeds, maybe even some fennel seeds and lots of sesame seeds, and adding that to
sesame
a salad.
Seeds, that's cool. Yeah, delicious.
And adding that to a salad. It just enlivens it. Mm-hmm. And using these spices in a very sort of playful and gentle way, like you don't need to overdo it, can really sort of enhance the the sort of creative experience of food and make the food taste a lot better without making it seem Indian.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just trying to show that you don't need it to be like, oh, this is the Indian night. Let
India.
Me take out my
yeah. no,
let
I agree.
Me take out my curry box.
Yeah.
You can sort of be like, oh, I'm making a salad dressing today. Let me add mustard seeds popped in a little bit of oil.
Delish.
And just blend it in.
Yeah. I love actually mint in a stir fry. Like,
yes.
Actually fresh and kind of wok it in there. And that's
I don't do that.
Yeah, it's a bit rogue, but it's really delicious. And it sort of has, you know how Thai basil has that kind of really aromatic flavour? Mint has that, I guess, because it infuses really well. That's why we put it in water and stuff.
Yeah, I love mint. Gosh.
Favourite spice? Is that too much? Is that too big
no,
a question?
No, I think I do have favourite spice. I think for me, turmeric is quite a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I know everyone talks about turmeric, but turmeric is one of those ones that really is so good for you, and it just is quite a key ingredient in Indian cooking. But it's not, it doesn't have as much flavour as, say, for example, ginger or mm-hmm. something. I think they're also key.
It's got colour though as well, doesn't it,
colour.
Turmeric, which is so fantastic. Gosh.
Yeah, I think I use turmeric and ginger a lot.
Yeah.
And ginger powder I have in hot water mm-hmm. quite a lot because it's so good for...
I was reading about that today,
actually. Yeah, it's very anti-inflammatory.
It's a good digestion
exactly.
aid, digestive aid.
It's very good. And, I mean, there's a lot of digestive aids. In my cafe, I serve fennel seeds in hot water.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many things you can just sprinkle. So that's, again, with the spice box and the spices, not just using them playfully, but also like, oh, today, instead of having normal water, I'll just put a few fennel seeds in my mm-hmm. water, and that will just be good for my digestion. Doesn't mean that you're battling constipation.
Yeah.
It just means that it's cooling your system a little bit
and just
helping your digestion a little bit. So it's just learning how to use these spices in a very sprinkly, playful and healthful way.
Mm-hmm. Sprinkly, healthful. I like that combination of words.
Making up words, basically.
So I think a lot of good dinner parties and meals are down to that experience as much as the food. And I wanted to know, what has been your kind of most memorable meal or dinner party kind of experience, food experience, let's say?
I think when I think of memorable food experiences, my first memory, the memory that pops to the top of my head is eating in this place called Vishala, which is about 1 hour away from the capital city of Gujarat in Ahmedabad. So it's like 1 hour away, and you go there and it's such an immersive experience where they serve you the sort of Gujarati thali on the floor on a pan, so it's a leaf, and they it's in the dark, and there's like dancers sort of dancing to live music. There's camels wandering around, so you can actually
cool.
go on a camel ride. So I was quite young when I went there.
Yeah.
But it's such an immersive experience, and they literally serve you like in the dark, where you have like lanterns and candle lit everywhere.
Wow.
It's all in the open, and they're pouring your things onto your plate, and they're giving you the soup and the dal and this, and they're literally, every time you finish something, they'll just pour more onto your plate, and it's, you don't know how much you eat. Obviously, you eat a lot, but it's so fresh and so authentic and so village food,
mm-hmm.
like the most village food that you'll get in the most glamorous, but in a village setting. So they're bringing the whole village culture to life. And there's all these dancers with like pots on their heads dancing around, and you can also dance, and there's live music and, you know, lanterns. It's just, it brings everything to life. And I think that's probably one of my most memorable experiences.
That's amazing.
And also being in the Rajasthan desert when I was, again, very young with my family, and having a meal in the dark, so in the dark, like in the deserts of Jaisalmer, which is right in the desert in mm-hmm. Rajasthan. We'd gone there on camels, and they were serving us curry, and I can't remember exactly what we ate. But again, it's just the ambience, the setting, where you are, and sort of the feeling you have at the time stays with you.
Mm-hmm. Being in nature, I guess.
Yeah, being in nature and being in the sort of expanse, the vast
yeah.
expanse of the universe.
Yeah.
Eating food.
Very cool.
Made by locals. So those are probably the most memorable experiences of food that I have.
So we're coming to the end. What do you have in store for 2019? Kind of, I guess, 2020.
Gosh, we can roll on. Yeah.
I know, scary
today. It really is scary.
But I think it's September, you know, always makes me feel a bit like a new year because it's that back to school feeling.
It really feels like that,
you know,
right now.
Obviously, you've just got the book. This has just come out.
Yeah, I know. I think 2020 will be really building on my well-being side
mm-hmm.
because I've moved in the last year from sort of food to well-being by having this cafe and try yoga, by writing a book which is more about sort of rituals, well-being
yeah.
and Ayurveda, and about food, but not focusing just on food, and sort of building on that whole side of things. I don't know exactly where it'll take me. There's a few things in the pipeline which are not yet confirmed, so I can't really talk about them. But there are things in the pipeline, and I'm really excited about 2020.
Good. It's a good way to be.
Yeah. It's exciting because also you also don't know what's in store for you, mm-hmm. which is quite nice.
And will you be doing more supper clubs and events and kind of yoga brunch club
yeah,
as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I've got yoga brunch club coming up.
So fun. Love yoga brunch club. People, if you don't know what yoga brunch club is, do check it out.
Look it up. Yeah, Alex and I have both done it. It's amazing.
It's fun.
So I've got two of them coming up for my book launch. I'm doing lots of events for my book launch. I'm not doing one big book launch. I'm doing Sweaty Betty Wellness Wednesday.
Yeah.
I'm doing like yoga brunch club, a yoga brunch at Tri Yoga, Il Apothecary, Remind Studio, just lots of different studios where I'm collaborating with people and doing talks. And
can people find all this kind of on your website and on your social media?
Yeah, social media, miramanic.com. And social media mainly, at Mira Manic and at Chai by Mira.
Perfect.
Thank
Brilliant.
You, Alex.
Well, it's always good to get that in there. So then, last two questions. If you could have three people for dinner, anyone in the world, who would you have and why?
So hard. I think the first person that pops to mind, I know it might be a little bit obvious, but Gandhi, because I've always just heard about and listened to him or like watched Gandhi, and he just always comes to mind when I think of people that have inspired me or who still continue to inspire me. My best friend, because I just have a laugh with her. Mm-hmm.
Good.
And we could have a whole
her and Gandhi.
And maybe my sister.
Nice.
Or my nephew, my oldest nephew, because he just comes out with the most profound lines that I think he needs to open a school of wisdom of his own. He's like, he's 10 years old and he literally comes out with the most profound lines of wisdom. So
maybe knows? He might be the next Gandhi. You have no idea. And then for all kind of entertainers, what are your kind of top three ingredients that you advise people to always have in the kitchen?
Top three ingredients.
Yeah.
The spice box. I know
the
that's
spice
not an ingredient.
No, you can have that. I'll give it to you.
It's just so like, it just works wonderfully for anything. There's a few spice mixes in there. Ingredients, right? Not mm-hmm. like, okay. And I would say lime and lemon.
Okay, cool. You can have that citrus.
Yeah.
Being really generous today.
What should be the third thing? God. I guess nuts. I love my nuts.
Okay, yeah.
I love walnuts.
Walnuts.
I guess those three come to mind right now. I'm sure I'll walk away thinking,
well, they're
oh
good
God,
finishers,
why
aren't they? Like one of, you know, the spices are great to put the base, the flavour into the base, and then you've got the finishers. So you've got nuts to kind of sprinkle on the top, and then you've got lime. Well, you know, that kind of everything needs salt, fat, acid,
exactly.
heat. You've kind of got that, haven't you?
Oh, wow. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, well, clearly you know about food then. Well, thank you so much,
thank
Mira. That
you,
was so
Alex.
Brilliant. Thank you for coming in.
I loved it. Thank you so much. And I can't wait to hear it. Thanks so much, Alex. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. If you liked it, rate it, review it, talk about it, share it, and invite your friends round for supper. This has been a Studio 71 production. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hmm. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.